lecture number 20. By the way, there's not going to be any lectures next week. But we'll have lectures probably the week after on the 10th. I don't know where we're going to have them. But, that'll close up the Old Testament survey when we do the minor prophets.
So, are you going to see anything next week then?
What?
Oh,
you're going to be away next week. Yeah, good. You lucked out.
Should I call you to find the directions to the week after next week's lecture?
Yeah. If you can give me a call sometime during that week, that'd be good. Okay, Book of Daniel, the author is Daniel. In Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus says that Daniel wrote this, okay? Daniel's also mentioned in Ezekiel 14, verse 14, verse 20, and chapter 28, verse 3. So Daniel was very famous for his wisdom and his leadership while in the Babylonian captivity. The critics, the higher critics, assume that predictions are impossible. Yet, Daniel makes some clear prophecies that are fulfilled. The time of Christ, the destruction of the temple, 70 AD, and the Christ being executed, 30 AD. He makes some predictions around 165 BC. And so, for the critics to assume that predictions are impossible, therefore Daniel's got to be dated later, you'd have to date Daniel after 70 AD, really, or at least after 165 BC, when the Roman Empire took over. So there's no sense whatsoever in trying to push Daniel back, because you've always got to go past the date when the Septuagint was recorded, the Hebrew Old Testament recorded into Greek, translated into Greek. And we know we had Daniel at that point about 200 years before Christ, and some of Daniel's prophecies were fulfilled after that point. So there's no sense in trying to push Daniel's date closer and closer to our time. It makes no sense whatsoever. The actual date, he probably wrote it between 605 BC and 536 BC. Reason being, Daniel in about 606 or 605 B.C. was probably in that first group of captives taken into Babylon. And he was a very young man, and they made him a leader among the Babylonians. Babylonians, when they were conquered, they would take the wisest from the nations they conquered and elevate them to positions of leadership. So that was about 605 B.C. when he was brought over there. Well, 536 B.C., Cyrus, the Medes and Persians take over, and Cyrus allows the Jews to go back to the Holy Land. So Daniel, who was under both the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians, had to have lived at least until the Medes and the Persians took over. So from about 605 B.C. to sometime around 536 B.C., what are the dates that they give in the talking through the Bible, or talk through the Bible? So as I mentioned, Daniel's taken captive and brought
626 to 640.
626? Yeah, I was going to say, man, that's some pretty bad dates. What's that?
625.
Yeah, because the Medes and the Persians, he made the decree in 536. It might have, I can't remember the exact date when the Medes and the Persians took over. I don't think I've got it listed down. But that's pretty good. Yeah, so 605, 536 BC, somewhere during that time, Daniel recorded this. Daniel wrote it from Babylon. He had been taken captive and brought to Babylon in 605 or 606 B.C. The name Daniel means God is judge. And this is the fifth and final book of the major prophets. Now, I'd like to say this as well. The title of this book if I had to give a title to the book of Daniel, I would probably call it No Compromise, because it's a book where you'll see that there's just a refusal on the part of Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, a refusal on their part to compromise the gospel in any way. Anyway, 12 chapters of Daniel, I just broke them down. There's so many different topics, I just broke them down and just talked about each chapter one at a time. So let's take a look at the book of Daniel, starting with chapter 1. Chapter 1, Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refused to defile themselves with the king's wine or meats. They were Babylonians. They had that policy: when you capture somebody, you take their young men with the most potential, and you feed them, you train them, you educate them in your ways, and you make them your leaders. So you use the best that the enemy has, and you use it for your own good. And so Daniel and his friends, though, refused to defile themselves with the king's wine or meats. Still, so that they were basically eating a bland diet because they refused to eat non-kosher food. But then they were still growing up bigger and stronger and healthier than the guys who were eating the king's wine and the king's meats. So God was prospering them, and they were eventually promoted and received high positions in the Babylonian kingdom. And so that's chapter 1. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of a statue. By the way, I should have... Here's a chart. Here's where Jerusalem's down here. And over here to the northeast, you have Babylon. Okay, so that's where they were taken captive. And so they were in Babylon now.
I want to use your stick.
What? Oh, yeah, that's right. I've got to use my stick here and get some use out of it. So I Jerusalem, they were taken captive to Babylon over there. Thank you, Tom. That's fair. I used it twice already. Nebuchadnezzar has a statue dream in chapter 2, and Daniel interprets the statue dream. Now, I'm just going to draw make a little drawing here of Nebuchadnezzar's statue. Down here you have 10 toes. But this is a statue dream, and the head of gold Daniel interprets the dream. The head of gold stood for the Babylonian Empire. Daniel interprets it that way. Then you go down a little further, and the next part is the empire of the Medo-Persian Empire. Daniel predicts they would knock the Babylonians off, and then they would rule. Then a little bit further down the statue, moving from the head down, Babylon being the head, you had the Daniel prediction it would be the empire of the Greeks, Greece. And then finally you'd end up with a fourth empire, which turns out to be the Roman Empire. Okay? But then Daniel comes up with some prophecies of the end times. And what we're going to see is the Babylonian Empire is going to get defeated by the Medes and the Persians, who get defeated by the Greeks, who eventually get defeated by the Romans. But then the Roman Empire is going to be split into two legs, east and west. And you find that with the Eastern Church and the Western Church, Rome and East split, the Holy Roman Empire was split in two. And it's kind of just around in name only, but there's really no strength to it. Well, in the last days, it's going to be revived. Still the same empire, but it's going to be revived and come back with the power it once had. And but it's going to be back with 10 toes, standing for 10 kings, or 10 kingdoms. Okay? And so you find that in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's statue dream. Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3 decides to build a gold image, a statue of himself, and that when the musicians play, everybody has to bow down and worship this statue. Take a look at verses 16 to 18 in Daniel chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're Daniel's three friends, also leaders in Babylon and Jewish men. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. He made a law that if you don't worship this image, you've got to be cast into a fiery furnace. They decided, we're not going to bow down to your idols. We're not going to serve your false god. And we're not going to bow down to the statues. So Nebuchadnezzar has to throw these three loyal guys into the fiery furnace. So they're thrown into the fiery furnace. Look at verses 23 to 25 of Daniel chapter 3. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He responded and said to his high officials, Was it not three men we cast bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, Certainly, O king. He answered and said, Look, I see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Now, some translations translate that like a son of God or a son of the God. The problem is Elohim, the name for God, is in the plural. So sometimes it's used of false gods, Elohim, and it's plural, gods. But sometimes it means the son of the true God, and it's singular. And it's meant singular even though it's used with a plural word. In other words, the God of the Bible, that's why I even said in Genesis 1:1, bara, the word for create, the verb is singular. So it demands that the subject be singular, yet the subject is plural. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth is Elohim, a God of three or more. So you could translate that, in the beginning, one God of three or more created the heavens and the earth. Now the Jews, because they don't believe in the Trinity, they claim it's just a poetic way to describe God's majesty, to talk about him in his majestic plurality. But whatever the case, we don't know if that means a son of the gods or a son of God. But whatever the case, Nebuchadnezzar saw that there was a being that appeared to be more powerful and more glorious than mere men that was in the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and delivered them from that situation. In chapter 4, King Nebuchadnezzar is humbled. In verses 28 to 37, King Nebuchadnezzar started to place himself above God, and God punished him, and he received some kind of disease or some kind of punishment where he grew hair and went out and lived with wild beasts for 7 years. Now let's take a look at those verses 28 to 37. All this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. The king reflected and said, Is this not Babylon the great? which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty. While this word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared sovereignty has been removed from you, and you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field, and you will be given grass to eat like cattle. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. Immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. By the way, there is some type of disease where you get that kind of thing. You actually grow hair and act animalistic, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I have read a little bit on that. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven. By the way, some of the legends of werewolves may be based on something along this lines, and there's even occultic practices where people engage in sexual intercourse and act like animals in the an occultic practice in the woods or a forest in an attempt to get themselves demon possessed and then to have sex and then in an attempt to become animal like. Yeah.
The head of this country is Nicholas Stret.
Oh yeah, what's his name? Nicholas what?
Nicholas Stret.
He's
like the first sort of rules.
Oh yeah, because there's a the hair with the werewolf type aspect, the hair is a non-factor, but the face actually goes into contortions and actually looks like an animal. There was a guy in London, his case seemed to me to be demon possession, where they were interviewing cops, where they were talking about him as being a werewolf or whatever, but Josh McDowell touches on that in his book on the occult. It's found also in his handbook of today's religions. Glorifying the werewolves and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and
well, what was the name of it?
Wolf.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, there were some movies back in the 80s that were promoting werewolves as well. A couple movies that were doing that. Anyway, so Nebuchadnezzar is humbled and he receives this, but at the end of that period, verse 34 of Daniel chapter 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing. But he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what hast thou done? At that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. So he receives his kingdom back, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are true, and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. And so Nebuchadnezzar is humbled, and then finally, when he trusts in the God of the Bible, he is restored to power. Belshazzar's feast and Babylon's defeat is recorded in chapter 5. Now Belshazzar apparently was a relative of Nebuchadnezzar, was his son or something, and there is some confusion about the kings and historically recorded and stuff, but apparently there was one son who was ruling, and when he was out fighting a battle, he left his brother or his nephew or his uncle in charge or something along those lines, or his nephew, and so there is some confusion historically on that, and it's reconciled real well by Walter Kaiser? Oh no, Gleason Archer in his survey of Old Testament introduction. Does a real good job with that. Anyway, verses 1 to 2 of chapter 5, Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of 1,000. So they figured that they could never be defeated. There was no way Babylon could be defeated, is what they thought. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. And remember, these are the same things that King Hezekiah of Judah had showed off. He was bragging, saying, look how wealthy we are, and he showed them off to the Babylonians. Babylonians came years later, knocked off Jerusalem, stole these. Now Belshazzar brings them and is going to make light of them, is going to be drinking from these vessels. And so God is highly ticked off. Look at verses 25 to 30. Anyway, so while they're partying it up, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing on the wall and wrote a message on the wall, and they couldn't interpret it. And so they needed to be interpreted. So take a look at 25 to 30. Daniel is brought up to interpret it, turns down the rewards, but said that God would give him. And Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as the father of Belshazzar, so Belshazzar should be the son or the grandson, possibly, of Nebuchadnezzar, one of those two. But Daniel is brought up to interpret it, and in verse 25 to 30, now this is the inscription that was written out: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene. God has numbered your kingdom. By the way, Mene just means to number. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. And tekel is like a form of either currency or scales or whatever, measurement of weight. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. And so God's basic message is, hey, your kingdom's been numbered, you've been weighed on the scales and found wanting, and God is going to punish you. Yeah? What's that? We just said that. Yeah, apparently Upharsin was just probably some form of the word that was translated into the Persians, that the Medes and the Persians would come. Anyway, verse 29, then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him, that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. So he was set up in third. And by the way, here's where it was. Secular history, Belshazzar is not listed as the king. And go to find out, there was somebody else who was in charge, not Belshazzar, but was out fighting a battle. And while he fought the battle, he left this guy in charge. And now this guy's in charge, so he's really only second in the kingdom. He's the acting king, but he's really only second in the king, and he loses to Daniel the Third. I believe that's the way it's reconciled by Gleason Archer. You might have to check into that book. But he makes him the third ruler in the kingdom, not the second. The same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede, so now the Medes and the Persians take over, received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And so what you have now is the Medes and the Persians have defeated Babylon, and so that statue dream is being fulfilled now. Okay? You have Daniel in the lion's den. Oh, but by the way, the takeover of Babylon was just amazing. I believe Babylon had a moat, this moat of water, around the city. The entire city was impossible to be crossed and all this stuff. And apparently what they did, the Medes and the Persians, was they formed a dam to block off some of the water, to clear the water, so they just traveled right on over and somehow. Yeah, but it was just amazing how they conquered. Daniel in the lion's den. You know, I hope I'm not confusing that with another battle now, too, another city that was taken, because there were several that were really phenomenal ancient battles. But Daniel in the lion's den in chapter 6, verses 20-23, at this point, only prayer to the king was allowed. You couldn't pray to your own God. Well, Daniel was praying three times a day to the God of Israel, and he would face Jerusalem and pray. And so Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, even though the king up with Babylon, the king was above the law, so the king could make a law, and then if he didn't like it anymore, he could change his mind, take the law back, or outlaw the law. With the Medes and the Persians, once the king made a law, the law was above the king. This king loved Daniel, but he made this law from bad advice from other people, wasn't thinking about Daniel at the time, and so when Daniel was caught praying, his enemies threw him into the lion's den, and he couldn't do anything about it. So Darius couldn't do anything about it, and he felt real bad and couldn't sleep that night when Daniel was in the lion's den. So look at verses 20-23. And when he had come near the den, that's the king, to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? So the next morning he comes thinking Daniel might be dead. And Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also towards you, O king, I have committed no crime. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. And so here Daniel is saved in the lion's den. It was probably both here and the fiery furnace of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was probably a visitation of the pre-incarnate Christ to protect them. The vision of the four beasts is mentioned in Daniel chapter 7, and it coincides with the statue dream. The four beasts. You have the lion, the bear, the leopard, and then an indescribable monster. Daniel interprets it, the lion, again was Babylon. The bear was the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire when they took over, the very next empire to take over after Babylon. The leopard had four heads and all, but that was Alexander the Great and the Greeks when they took over, knocked off the Medes and the Persians, and then the Israelites were ruled by them. Then the four heads, it was this kingdom was split into four ways after he died. He had no heir. Alexander the Great, a lot of people don't realize that he was actually a pupil of Aristotle. And Aristotle taught that there's two kinds of people in the world. There's the Greeks and there's the barbarians. And the Greeks ought to take over the world and let the barbarians, everybody else, be their slaves and do their work for them, so they could sit around and talk philosophy and politics all day, because they were the intellectually elite. They had the master race mentality long before the Nazis ever came up with it. And Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, God is dead and all traditional values have died with him, therefore we need a breed of supermen to create their own values, he used as an example of this the ancient Greeks. And then the Nazis took Nietzsche's writings plus the idea of the ancient Greeks and came up with their masquerade thinking. But he was 16 under Aristotle being taught this. He figured, hey, that's great, I'm going to take over the world. By the age of 25, he had basically taken over the known world, and then he pardoned himself to death and died at the age of 33, leaving no male heir. So his kingdom was split four ways by four of his generals, and Antiochus Epiphanes was one of them, and Aristotle needed. Epicureans were pretty much like secular humanists. They pretty much taught that matter is all there is, and that do what pleases you. And they weren't hedonistic in the modern sense of the term, but basically what pleases you is right. Stoics, though, were more pantheists, were more like New Agers. Aristotle was a lot closer to a theist, although he was not a Christian and he was not a believer in any means of the term, but he would be a lot closer to it than they would have been. What's that? And then there under Marcion, though, here's the Roman Empire. And so in Daniel chapter 7, you have the prophecy of the vision of these four beasts. And again, the prophecy here, verses 12 to 14 of Daniel chapter 7, we should read that. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. By the way, you also have 10 horns which stand for 10 kings and 10 kingdoms in that final beast, the monster, the revived Roman Empire, 10 nations that will be defeated by the Antichrist. That will be defeated by Christ at his second coming. But there's a lot of predictions about the Antichrist making war with the saints, making himself like the Most High God. Yeah.
Is the people on the left church enough to know that the Roman Church will keep their own?
I haven't heard that they're thinking of getting back, but they were basically, that was a big bitter break when they broke.
Did they work connected with them one time?
Yeah, but they broke off way before the problem. They broke off before we did. They broke off before the Protestants did. One goes back to about 1000 AD. It was one break, but one go even predates it to about 400 AD. They didn't like the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, gaining more power. And I'm not sure which is which. I'd have to look it up and stuff. But they go way back to a break from Rome. I don't know, because I know it's called the Russian Orthodox Church too, but I'm not sure. I'd have to really look into it. I'm not even sure if the Greek Orthodox Church, if that's synonymous with the Eastern Orthodox Church. I'll have to look into it, and I'll get back with you on that. Anyway, in Daniel chapter 8, you have the vision of the ram goat and the he goat, and it turns out that the he goat is Alexander the Great, and he defeats the Persians, which is the ram, represented by the ram. Alexander's kingdom was divided four ways. He had four generals: Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And then Antiochus Epiphanes came from, I can't remember if he was from the Ptolemies or the Seleucids, but he came from one of those two. And so certain predictions of Antiochus Epiphanes are given in Daniel chapter 8. So it's real good reading, because he was a type of the Antichrist. So a lot of the things he did, the Antichrist will also do. The Daniel 70 weeks prophecy is in Daniel chapter 9, 24 to 27. These, by the way, to make a long story short, are 70 weeks of years. So you have 490 years that are predicted. The Jews did not rest the land on every seventh year. So God said, I'll take all those 7 years. You had arrested 70 of them, and you're going to be captive in Babylon for 70 years, which Jeremiah predicted. And Daniel talks about Jeremiah's prophecy the 70 years earlier on. And what he's saying is, we're about to be set free and allowed to go back to the Holy Land. And that those days are coming. And so he was appealing to that prophecy. But God, in the 70 weeks prophecy, said 490 years are going to occur before, from the order to rebuild Jerusalem with its walls and all, which was given in 444 B.C., until atonement is made for the people, is going to be 490 years. However, what we find here is a 483, and actually it's the Millennium Kingdom, okay, where the fullness of this occurs. So, but you've got 483 years in here, and when you figure it out, when you change the years to biblical years of 360 days, it comes right out to about 30 A.D. It predicts that right at that time, the side of the prince will be cut off. So let me just read it for you. 444 B.C. is found, that date is also found in Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 5 to 8, the order to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Anyway, 70 weeks, now these are weeks of 7 years of peace, so it's 490 years. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make an atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. So you add those together, 69 weeks, 483 years. Then after the 62 weeks, which are after the 7 weeks, so after 483 years, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. So of course, right about 30 A.D., the Messiah has to come on the scene and be executed. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy, or prince who is to come, the Antichrist, his people, the Romans, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That was 70 A.D. And its end will come like a flood. Even to the end there will be war. Desolations are determined. And it says, and he will make, talking about the prince who is to come, the Antichrist, will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. So it's a 7-year treaty. But in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. On the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. What you have here is 483 years from 444 B.C. the Messiah will come and be revealed, then he'll be executed, and that occurred. Temple will be destroyed in 70 A.D., and his 70th week will come. What you have is you have a gap between the 69th week and the 70th week. After the 69th week is completed, the Messiah will be cut off. The temple's destroyed. That came about 35 years later, 40 years later. The whole church age has been going on. And then finally, there's going to be one more week left, what we call the 7-year tribulation period, although I think it would be more scripturally sound to just say the last half of those 7 years is the tribulation period. But whatever the case, this 7-year period of time has to occur. And then, at the end of that time, that's when all those things in verse 24 will come about, when transgression will be finished, an end of sin, atonement will have been made for iniquity, everlasting righteousness will come in, vision and prophecy will be sealed up because you've got Jesus right there. You no longer need him to reveal things to you through vision and prophecy. And the most holy place will be anointed by the Messiah himself. So that's Daniel's 70th week prophecy, one of the most amazing prophecy in the scriptures. In Daniel chapter 10, you have some things mentioned about the angelic warfare. Look at verses 12 to 14. Then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. Daniel prays for, and he's trying to get an answer from a prayer, and this guy says, I couldn't give you an answer because the prince of the kingdom of Persia would help. How can the prince of an earthly kingdom keep an angel from getting a message across? Well, the answer is, because the prince this guy is talking about, the prince of Persia, is not the physical prince of Persia, but the spiritual prince of Persia, the demon who's controlling him. And so Michael the archangel has to come, who's one of the chief princes, because he had been left there with the kings of Persia. And so battle was going on, and so on the demonic realm, and so Michael the archangel had to help this angel get the message, the answer to Daniel's prayer. Verses 20 and 21 of Daniel chapter 10, then he said, do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. So now, the demon in charge of Greece is going to come, and they're going to knock off the Medes and the Persians, who already knocked off the Babylonians. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth, yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces, except Michael, your prince. So Michael the archangel is out there battling in this angelic warfare that is going on. Wars between the king of the north and the king of the south are mentioned. Covers a lot of history from Alexander the Great to Ptolemies. The Ptolemies were the the Greek Empire split four ways in the south. The Ptolemies were in Egypt. The Seleucids were in the north in Syria. Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the Seleucids. And he was prefigured the Antichrist. But battles between the kings of the north, king of the north and the king of the south. King of the north pretty much was the Syria area or the Iran-Iraq area. King of the south were the from Egypt and all. In the last days, it appears that the king of the north, king of the south will come back. I think the king of the north is probably going to be Iraq, and he's going to lead a northern confederation of Arab tribes. King of the south, probably going to be headed by some clown like Muammar Gaddafi or whatever, but they're going to be at war with each other even in the last days. And that's brought out in chapter 11. And then chapter 12 talks about the tribulation period and the resurrection of believers. Look at the first three verses. Now at that time, Michael the archangel, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. And there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. That's the tribulation period. At that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Believers will be saved. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. So the resurrection. And those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. And those who lead the many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever. Then in verse 4, but as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase. It seems to predict that the last days travel there'll be fast travel and knowledge, advanced technology. And, you know, 1903, the Wright brothers were the first ones to get a heavier-than-aircraft in the sky for a decent amount of time. 66 years later, 1969, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And so mankind's technology is advancing in leaps and bounds. These may be the last days. But certainly the book of Daniel, an incredible book written by an incredible prophet.
And chapter 12, verse 3, what do they mean by insight?